6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. All engine running. Liftoff. We have a liftoff. 32 minutes past the hour. Liftoff on Apollo 11. Tower cleared.
Here we got a roll program.
Neil Armstrong reporting their roll and pitch program, which puts Apollo 11 on a proper heading.
From KPCC's Crawford Family Forum, it's a special hour of Air Talk, one small step 50 years later. Good morning. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us in our Crawford Family Forum. We've got a terrific selection of guests who'll talk about the significance of this milestone, 50 years of Apollo 11, its landing, the first moonwalk. We're also going to hear about Los Angeles County's vital role in the Apollo missions, as well as the other space missions that preceded it. We begin with John Cassani, who started the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in the mid-1950s, pre-Sputnik. He was an integral part of JPL's evolution from rocket builder to designer of spacecraft. John was a leader or led missions with familiar names: Pioneer, Ranger, Mariner, Voyager, Galileo, and Cassini. He's lived the history of NASA. John, thank you for being with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you, Larry. Pleasure to be here.
Every 10 years, you get a chance to sort of relive the greatest technological achievement. And I just wonder, over all these years, what Apollo 11 holds in your emotions today.
Well, when I think about Apollo 11, I really think of what some people refer to as the Apollo effect. Have you heard that term?
No.
Well, the effect was when the country announced its intention to put a man on the moon and return him safely in 10 years, it really created a tremendous interest among the whole country, but young people especially. And the net effect with that was that a lot of people switched career and became interested in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, STEM. And that really started the whole STEM movement. And that formed the fundamental basis, infrastructure, that enabled us to move like we have over the last 50 years into all forms of space exploration. That was the enabling. That was the trigger.
So that's what you think most about.
I think most about, yes. Kind of boring, isn't it?
No. Anita Sengupta is a rocket scientist, because it does take a rocket scientist to have this discussion. She was at JPL and in the private sector for a number of years. She's now research associate professor of aeronautics at USC. Anita, I know the human accomplishment of this means a great deal to you, but what, as an engineer yourself, what stands out most to you about the technical side of what Apollo 11 accomplished?
So I think it's probably one of the most complicated engineering feats of humanity. And so just in terms of the complexity of being able to design something for an environment that you've never been to before and have it work sort of the first time is just tremendous in terms of having to understand the physics behind everything that you're doing, whether it's from the design of the engines to the navigation of the spacecraft to what the environment was going to be for the human beings to be able to survive there for that time. So I actually can't think of a greater engineering accomplishment for our species than Apollo.
And a little bit later, we'll hear on the human side what the effect was on you and on your colleagues looking back on this. Also, historian Peter Westwick directs the Aerospace History Project for the Huntington USC Institute on California and the West. He's also a research professor of history at SC. And Peter, I know you're native Angeleno also, grew up here in Southern California. Yep. So you know, we tend to think of Southern California's role with NASA is all these extraordinary robotic missions. Mm-hmm. But take us back to the importance of Southern California in aerospace in the Apollo era.
Yeah, I mean, Apollo was really largely made in Southern California. A lot of both the Saturn rocket, the stages, the motors were built here, and much of the command module also, and then also components like parachutes, things like that. So a lot of Apollo, you know, the astronauts were carried to the moon on machines that were made here in Southern California.
All right. Frances Poppy Northcutt was the first woman to work in an operational support role at NASA's Mission Control Center in Houston. She first did it for Apollo 8 and continued through subsequent missions. Poppy's featured in the new IMAX documentary Apollo 11, First Steps Edition. It's playing through September at the California Science Center and playing nationwide. The film's director, Todd Douglas Miller, provided us with this archival clip of Poppy providing a calculation to one of the flight controllers.
This is Apollo Control Houston at 79 hours, 51 minutes. I'm now onto the flight of Apollo 11. Astronaut Charles Duke has arrived on the scene.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah.
What put us 4 minutes ahead?
We arrived at the moon 4 minutes early. Speaks well for the booster.
Well, no.
Retro support, maybe on reentry support loop.
Go ahead.
Why didn't we get a post-parasynchron for that trip time?
Just wanted what to kind of a constraint did you have in there on VR Max at that time?
37.5. That's less than that.
Well, let me put it this way. The curve with transit time of VR Max is almost straight up. So if you had run the trade-off for the 38K, you probably would have gotten it.
Yeah.
In over 11,000 hours of mission control audio, Poppy's is the only woman's voice that you hear in 11,000 hours. So she was in town last week, right here at KPCC, and I asked her about the computation that she was providing in that clip that we just heard.
We, during a mission, would work on verifying hundreds of returns to Earth that were being just looked at, not necessarily because we planned to fly them, but because you always want to be ready and know what your alternatives are in case something comes up. So I think the thing that when people talk about this little clip that they may see, that was not a planned trans-Earth injection. That was just something that the retrofire officer was looking at as a possibility. He was looking at minimizing his trip time. And he just really didn't realize that he needed more fuel. That was why he was having problems. He didn't have the fuel constraints high enough.
I then asked Poppy if she and her mission control colleagues had assumed that the Apollo missions were the prelude for going to Mars.
I thought we would have landed. If you talked to me during the flight of Apollo 11, I would have said, oh, yeah, we'll probably be on Mars in 10, 15 years.
Wow. And so are you disappointed that here we are in 2019 and you know, we're not there?
I'm heartbroken. I'm heartbroken. I've been heartbroken. I mean, how worse can it be that we have to hitchhike into space? We don't even have a launch vehicle yet. We haven't had a launch vehicle for years.
Well, and still, where do you put the blame for that? Because there was, during this era where have an important role in the Apollo and Gemini before that, there's this feeling of everybody pulling together, can do, whatever it takes to spend. So how did the U.S. lose that, in your view?
Well, you ask about where do I put the blame. I mean, maybe it should be reframed. I mean, maybe we should look at where do we put the credit for what we did, okay? And looking at it 50 years later, I sure am glad that Lyndon B. Johnson was president, because Lyndon B. Johnson is the one that got the money.
And I wondered if Poppy saw cultural differences between her NASA of the mid-60s and the NASA of today.
I think there probably is. First of all, because go back to where we were 50 years ago and what was going on in the space race. First of all, NASA, yes, it was a civilian agency, but it was very influenced in its culture by the military. I think it's less influenced in its culture by the military at this time, you know, just because it's evolved more as a civilian agency with, you know, it still has some military feel to it, but I think that's a big difference, for one thing. Also, we have an influx. We have women in positions, flight directors, flight controllers, and so forth in these non-manned missions. And if you look around the room, everybody in there is not white anymore.
In fact, it's international.
Exactly. But they're not, you know, you look at those pictures from the Mission Operations Control Room, what do you see?
Yeah.
A whole bunch of white men. And white shirts, even. I mean, they're even, you know, they're even all dressed alike. They're all in what we used to call the IBM dress code.
I asked Poppy about her being the only woman in mission control and how that made her a focal point with media. And I asked her whether there was a downside to that.
Well, it was a lot of the treatment by the media was very sexist. And I would have preferred to have been the 100th woman in mission control. But I felt it was an opportunity getting out there to let other women know that women could do those jobs. And I think that that was a positive. In fact, I know for certain it was.
I was going to ask if you heard from women who saw you in those interviews or read about you.
Exactly. See, I was contacted by the Brazilian consulate 6-8 weeks ago about a woman at JPL who was a Brazilian, Brazilian-born, Brazilian-raised, who wanted to locate me because when she was a little girl, she said that she was influenced to go into planetary science because she saw news coverage of me out of Apollo 13.
That's got to be very gratifying.
Pretty amazing.
Poppy Northcutt, the first woman to work in an operational support role at NASA's Mission Control in Houston. Her missions included Apollo 11. We're marking its 50th anniversary on this special edition of Air Talk from our Crawford Family Forum at KPECC. And we remind you we're also streaming at kpecc.org. You can watch the video of this as well as listen on 89.3 KPECC. Let me go back to John Cassani, who was there back from the mid-1950s all the way through these robotic as well as human missions. And I want to ask about the intensity of the space race, how this changed the work that you were doing. Because once you have Kennedy make his famous speech about sending a man to the moon, how did things change?
Well, the budget climate changed dramatically. I mean, right now the NASA budget for the last, I don't know, 20, 30, 50 years has been on the order of 0.5% of the total national budget. In the Apollo days, it was 5%. So it was a big difference.
It's hard to even comprehend. 5% of our U.S. budget was spent on NASA.
That's right. That's right. Getting ready to put people on the moon. That's what it was.
And this is the same time the Vietnam War is going on.
The same time the Vietnam War is going on. Exactly. Yeah. So I think that we were aware. We were working on spacecraft. Our job at JPL was to design and build spacecraft that could go to Venus and Mars. I led the design team for the Ranger. That was the first one. And then subsequently for Mariner 2. So we were very much aware, for instance, with Mariner 3 and 4, which is going to be the first spacecraft to Mars, that the Russians had tried it 2 years before that and had failed. And they had another spacecraft going to Mars at the same time ours was going to Mars. And so there was a lot of, we didn't want to be. we wanted to be first, but we wanted to get there. And we didn't want to have a problem like the Russians had. We didn't know what their problem was. But so the only thing we could do was focus on the things that we were working on and make sure that everything we were doing, we did it as well as it could be done. And so people were committed to that. We were working very long hours. Families were affected. Lives were affected. It was intense.
What was the feeling of what the stakes were? I mean, at the same time, so you're describing all these people, new people are coming in, the budget gets enlarged, and then what is the feeling that the stakes of your work represent?
The
stakes, how high are the stakes?
Oh, the stakes, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know that we really focused on that too much. I think the what we were doing was the most important thing we could think of doing. You know, there was nothing else that competed with us. And we weren't too much focused on the Russians. I said that because we knew that was going on. But we didn't have time to worry about that. We were trying to make what we had to do, make sure that was going to work properly. So there was pressure there. But the focus of it was not the Russians. The focus of it was our own internal problems and problem solving.
Peter Westwick, I wanted to ask you in more detail about the aerospace industry. I mean, during this era, we've got Douglas, Northrop, Lockheed, North American, Hughes. Mm-hmm. I mean, all these. This is an aerospace center. Hundreds of thousands of people work in the industry. Take us back to how big a driver this was for the Southern California economy.
Right. I mean, I think when you talk to people on the street and they say, you know, what's the industry in Southern California, L.A., the industry is Hollywood, right? That's the first thing most people think about. But, I mean, in this period, from World War II through this early part of the Cold War and the space race especially, I mean, the industry was aerospace. And I think most people who grew up here, like myself, understand that, you know, everybody had every family members, neighbors, friends who worked in the industry. I mean, it was 0 degrees of separation. So many people were in the business. And it was really central. I mean, Apollo poured hundreds of millions of dollars into Southern California, and that was really what fueled this, you know, tremendous growth of Southern California in this period.
Well, and whole communities came up right around this time. Lakewood, prime example, Hawthorne, Inglewood expanded. I mean, so many of these communities either, you know, came into existence or grew tremendously.
Right. And you can trace that to, you know, the particular companies that are working on Apollo. So Rocketdyne out in Canoga Park is building the J2 and the F1 rocket motors for Saturn. And it expands hugely in this period. And that's that whole western end of the San Fernando Valley is, you know, back then, you look at pictures before and after Rocketdyne was, you know, nothing. And then
Reseda and Winnetka,
yeah, exactly,
and all,
yeah,
these.
Yeah, rolling out the carpet. So, and that was, aerospace was driving that.
And what specifically of the Apollo mission were designed or built here in Southern California?
So, right, you had these, so the rocket motors out at Canoga Park and Rocketdyne, the J2 and F1 motors, the second and third stages built by North American in Huntington Beach, or in Seal Beach, and Douglas in Huntington Beach. North American and Downey built a lot of the command module that the astronauts were riding in. And then there were smaller components, the parachutes and things like this that were, you know, the smaller suppliers around town. TRW had a hand in some stuff. So it was really dispersed across the whole L.A. basin in Southern California. It was really, you know, a lot of people. The estimates kind of vary, but, you know, 40,000 is probably the low end of people who are working on Apollo in this area.
Wow. Peter, you know, there's been a lot written by historians about how Southern California became the center of movies, and a lot of it was sort of the timing, obviously, the geography, the weather. But it's interesting to go back with flight and the beginning of that, and how Southern California came to be an aerospace center. I know one of the big factors was a 1910 air exhibition held here.
Right. It was the 1910 L.A. Aviation Meet. It was the first international air meet held in the United States. And it was not a coincidence that it was held here in Southern California. One thing is local boosters, people like, you know, Henry Huntington and others really seized on the aircraft. You know, back then, 1910, this is just several years after the Wright brothers. And L.A. at the time was kind of a provincial burg, and they were looking for, you know, how do we put L.A. on the map and what's the future? And they looked at the airplane as this is the technological future and also the industrial future. And they said, there was actually a quote from one of the local boosters who said, you know, there's going to be a Detroit of the American aircraft industry. Let's make it happen here in L.A. And they put the money in to make this air meet happen in L.A. instead of somewhere else in the country. And that was one of the, you know, one of the main instigators of what then, you know, grew into this huge industry.
And I was surprised to learn how cooperative the aerospace the aeronautical companies were with each other, that we think of them all, you know, of course they would mm-hmm. be competitors. They're trying to, you know, get their bid, be the winning one for a contract, but they did work together a lot.
Yeah. And it was, I mean, don't underestimate the competition. I mean, they were out to beat each other. and a lot of them did fail and go through bankruptcy and then come back. But one factor was that there was a lot of kind of cross-pollination of engineers going from one firm to another. So Jack Northrop, for example, works for Douglas. No, works for Lockheed, goes for Douglas, back to Lockheed, goes off on his own. And there's this kind of peregrination of the engineers from firm to firm. And you can multiply that example by the thousands. So a lot of engineers had kind of bounced around, and there's this kind of pollination of ideas. No, I know they're doing this over at this company, and now they're doing this here. So, and following the contracts. So there was a lot of intersection.
We're talking with Peter Westwick, who is with the Huntington USC Center on the American West, and he has been doing extensive work on Southern California's role with NASA, with aerospace, whole archives that have been put together, documentation, including oral histories and the like from people who were pioneers in the industry.
Right, and it's fascinating. And one thing that we've noticed with people, especially who worked on Apollo, is the sense, you know, a lot of the business here was military, just defense industry. There was some commercial aircraft, but a lot of it came, especially in the Cold War, to focus on defense projects. Often classified, so you had to go through and get your security clearance and everything. And one of the things, and NASA in the 60s did have this very strong flavor of, as Poppy mentioned, of this, you know, Air Force influence especially. But one thing about the Apollo product was it was civilian and unclassified, and you could go home and talk about the work with your wife and kids and your neighbors and friends. And that was a major appeal for the people who otherwise, you know, if you're an aerospace engineer in the 60s, odds are you're going to be working on weapon system. And this is the era of Vietnam and some questions about, you know, do I really want to be working on this stuff? So engineers really jumped at the chance to work on, here is this, you know, transcendent civilian mission. You know, we're taking humans somewhere they haven't been before, as opposed to just building another kind of missile or weapon system. Some of these engineers there, they talk about it as, and I quote, Camelot.
Yeah, I'll bet.
Echoing Kennedy.
I don't know whether you had the experience growing up in Southern California, Peter, any of you attending here at the Crawford Family Forum, but I had several friends who they couldn't talk. They didn't know what their dads did when they went off to work. Their mothers didn't know what their dads did for this very reason that you described,
right.
Government contract work, working aerospace companies, and they just couldn't talk about anything.
Yeah, and it's really, I mean, this, and the community of this secret community was huge. You know, at the time, back then, pretty much everybody got a clearance just by default going into the business, and you couldn't talk about this stuff. And I think, first of all, the investigations were very intrusive, and they asked very probing questions about your background and what you'd like to do. But the effects on that, on Southern California society and culture, I think historians are just beginning to really scratch the surface of what that meant for Southern California's life here, to have this, you know, security regime superimposed on it. I mean, very, very profound and chilling, it seems.
You're reminding me of something I hadn't thought about in years. When I was a kid, a government investigator knocked on our door to ask about our next-door neighbors, and it was a man and a woman, and they started asking me as a little kid questions about the next-door neighbors. So,
right.
I thought, wow.
Yeah.
I was then asked to talk with my parents. It takes us back to a whole different climate in Southern California. We're joining you from the Crawford Family Forum at KPCC as we observe the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 landing and the first walk on the moon, an extraordinary event. Anita Sengupta, for many years with JPL and working in the private aerospace, now professor at USC. I saw you smiling as you were listening to Poppy, and she said to us, by the way, I'm so glad Anita's going to be on the panel. I mean, she's a real rocket scientist. She does this work. So she was excited about it. What were your thoughts as you were hearing her talk?
Well, so Poppy and I did a Women in Space STEM book project together, and so I reached out to her end of last week saying, you're in LA, let's meet up so we can sign each other's books. And so she invited me to the screening at the California Science Center on Saturday. So we met, watched the movie together, and then had lunch. And so she's a hero. What she went through as a woman at NASA at that time is just kind of, you know, earth-shattering for me to think about it from my perspective. And she's brilliant, and she's actually a huge advocate for women's rights, and she's an attorney now. So I am so thankful for people like her, because she basically paved the way and trailblazed for everybody else who came next.
What the Apollo 11 mission, how inspirational, significant was that for you in getting into engineering?
So I knew that I wanted to be involved in the space program since the age of six. Obviously, I was born after Apollo program started, but I was a child of the space shuttle era. And so one of my earliest memories of the space program was the disaster, which I guess was, I forgot now if it was 1986. Yes, I was in grade school. And so we were all very closely watching Christopher Krista McAuliffe in terms of what her progress was through her training. And so we were all watching the launch. And so after that disaster, I think even as a small child, you realize sort of the risk reward of the human space program. And so we all viewed her as a hero, the fact that she put herself on the line for something like that. So that impacted me in a profound way. But I always knew that I wanted to be involved in space exploration because I'm a huge science fiction fan. So the idea of discovering what else is out there and actually putting people in the steps of where you're going to go next is kind of the holy grail.
Well, and robotic missions obviously can generate so much important science. You can send machines to places you could never send a human. What is the significance, though, for you of human missions? Why do you think they're important when robots can do so much?
So it depends upon what you think we go into space for. So I think, in general, human beings are explorers by their very nature, whether or not it's exploring some new place on your vacation, whether it's not people moving around the planet trying to find new places to live and acquire land and set up cities and countries. So it's in our nature, it's in our blood, it's in our DNA to explore. So the next step for human beings is pretty obviously to actually leave our planet and to go and set up a spacefaring society beyond, whether it's to the moon or to Mars, further into our solar system, into another solar system. And so because of that nature to explore, that's the reason why people love the human space program, because they can see themselves in those astronauts, in those commercial astronauts. That being said, from an engineering perspective, the robotic space program is key to paving the way to develop the technologies in a safe, sophisticated manner so that we can feed that forward into human space exploration.
So what do you say to those who don't give so much value to our wiring to be explorers, who say, you know, we don't have enough resources to solve our problems on this planet. Why are we putting billions of dollars into going elsewhere? What do you say to people who are skeptical?
Well, there's a really easy way to answer that question, which is if you take a look at the growth of our economy across the globe in the past several decades, most of that is due to things related to e-commerce, related to mobile telecommunications. So without the space program, we wouldn't have had the economic growth that we've seen over the past several decades. So space actually leads to growth in the economy, which leads to jobs everywhere. Now, you could make the argument now, and I think that argument is already being made, that there's now a commercial place for space exploration for people, and we see the advent of the private space sector with SpaceX, Blue Origin, Virgin Galactic, right, where we're lowering the cost per kilogram to orbit, which facilitates this further human exploration. So now I think we have to say, as sort of like a business community, and now I'm an entrepreneur with an aerospace company, is there a business case for space? And if that's the case, now we can shift over to the private sector and start going further out into the stars using a business model for it.
So are you concerned, though, that as the private sector takes more and more of that space, that sort of the, you know, common benefit is lost? It ends up being space exploration for the wealthy.
Well, so I believe that robotic space exploration from a scientific perspective, planetary science, it's my passion. It's what I did the majority of my career. I was at JPL for 16 years. And so for me as an individual, I am so fascinated by exploring other worlds. And we have to do that robotically first for so many reasons. Probably the biggest one is radiation, right? We can't go to the Jovian system as people right now for a whole variety of reasons, but one, because the radiation will kill us. So I think there's two different paths to space exploration. There is the scientific path of understanding our place in the universe by exploring our own solar system, by exploring exoplanets, by exploring the rest of the cosmos using astronomy. And then there's this business case for space-based power, communications, and eventually manufacturing space, like, for example, Blue Origin and Jeff Bezos want to do.
We're talking with Anita Sengupta, rocket scientist, aerospace engineer, and research associate professor of astronautics at the University of Southern California. Also with us on this special 1 hour of Air Talk, One Small Step. We're joined by Peter Westwick, director of the Aerospace History Project at the Huntington USC Institute on California in the West. He's also a research historian at USC, professor there. And John Cassani, pioneering engineer for JPL. He goes back to the mid-1950s, and he either led or was on major teams for all the various robotic and solar system missions that took place leading up to and continuing after the Apollo missions. We're going to be continuing and hearing more from our panelists on the program, and we invite you also to watch it as we stream it at kpcc.org. If you're listening to the program on our Saturday broadcast, you can also visit kpecc.org and you can see a live stream of our conversation from the very beginning. We'll continue with that. And also want to remind you, coming up on Monday's Air Talk, it's our weekly politics panel. We'll be focused on just a little bit of political news that's taken place over the past few days. We'll talk about the controversies of the past few days, and we'll give you the very latest news as of Monday morning on that. This is One Small Step. 50 years later, as we observe the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 landing and the first walk on the moon, we'll be back right after this.
We copy you down, Eagle.
Houston, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
Roger, Tranquility. We copy you on the ground. You got a bunch of guys about to turn blue. We're breathing again. Thanks a lot.
From KPECC's Crawford Family Forum, this is One Small Step, 50 Years Later, an Air Talk special. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us. In case you just tuned in, let me reintroduce our terrific panel joining us in conversation to observe the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 landing and the first walk on the moon. With us, John Cassani, man who's been from the beginning at JPL as a transition from building rockets to designing aircraft, designing spacecraft, I should say. He's there from the mid-1950s all the way up through the important projects of JPL over the years. Anita Sengupta, rocket scientist for 16 years at JPL, also working in the private industry in aerospace, and she is currently a research professor at the University of Southern California. And joining us as well, a historian who has worked very closely on putting together a comprehensive archives of Southern California's role in the space race and in aerospace, Peter Westwick of the Huntington USC Institute on California and the West. He's also a research professor, just like Anita, at the University of Southern California. All right. Thank you all very much. So, John, let me go back to you to ask you back, because we were hearing about all, you know, one of the reasons for doing this is the technology that decades later we get out of the projects. In the case of the Apollo mission, what are some of the things that we have that we wouldn't, if not for Apollo, or at least would have been delayed?
Well, I mean, the whole spectrum of the technologies that are involved in space exploration really had their origin in the work that was done on the Apollo. So the answer to that question is everything, right? It's rocketry, it's communication, it's guidance and navigation, it's building and designing the equipment that support those functions. All of that came, you know, its origins were with the Apollo program. And most important is what I said before, at least in my vision, it has attracted people into STEM fields. And without the people, without the young people going into engineering, science, and mathematics, we wouldn't have any of this. we were talking about, or Peter, I guess, was, you know, the fact that the military work, which is also very, very much a presence here, but it was classified. NASA comes along, and we do programs that are not classified. What does that mean? That means companies like TRW, like Hughes, that were trying to build up their staff, they couldn't talk about the programs they were doing for the military, but they could put out on their advertising brochures, come work for us, we have this important job with NASA, da-da-da-da. And that was, they could attract young people by advertising and promoting. And once they got them in there, they would put them on the NASA programs, and when they got to be really good, they switched them to the military programs, which is where the profit was. So that was another sort of a minor problem that we had. We had a lot of young turnover with the industry that we'd look to support the work we were doing. Yeah,
Anita, one of the things that we hear a lot about the computer power of Apollo was, oh, it's hundreds of thousands of times more limited than our smartphones because of the memory and computational power. But I was reading an interesting piece that made the case that really doesn't compare the abilities. That the computer that was in Apollo 11 was extraordinarily nimble, and that the software that ran it enabled it to do all kinds of things that our phone could never do. We couldn't run an Apollo mission with our phone.
It's true, but there's it's true. It's just that there's also a weight and a power issue associated with it. So a lot of that would now be compressed into something which is much smaller, which means that you have more payload space to do something else, and you're dissipating less power. So there's it couples to the overall system design. So if you have more computationally efficient, volume efficient, mass efficient, power efficient computer skills, then it changes the way you architect your mission.
So when you look at the ability, given the state of computers at that point, for that mission to be carried out, do you marvel at what was accomplished with that?
I do, yes, and not even on the mission, but also prior to the mission. So a lot of the way we design activities now is using computational design techniques, whether that's from a structural analysis perspective, a thermal analysis perspective, an aerodynamics perspective, which is key for the reentry aspect of human spaceflight. So those capabilities didn't exist back then. They had to do sometimes 1D node calculations. They had to do so much more experimentation. So the challenge that they faced was tremendous from a design perspective because of the limitations in computational power.
So if we were to look at going to Mars again, given the state of technology today, what do you see as the biggest gaps to making that mission happen?
So for sure, in my opinion, it's a technology one. So when you land a robotic spacecraft on Mars, it has a certain amount of mass that you have to land to the surface, which is a couple of thousand kilograms, let's say. So if you have to land a human mission to surface, because you have to carry a lot of things that are unique to people, resources, consumables such as oxygen, water, and food supplies, you have to land a lot more on the surface. So entry, descent, and landing technologies are things that have to be developed specifically for the human scenario of landing people on the surface of Mars. And so that's very challenging to do because it's very capital intensive. You have to spend a lot of time drafting up test programs, which you can do here on Earth to show that it will work when you get to Mars. And then also the other element to it is radiation protection. So when you get beyond, the cocoon of Earth, you're in a very difficult radiation environment, both in the interplanetary cruise transit to Mars as well as on the Martian surface. And so those technologies from a radiation protection perspective don't actually exist yet.
So you'd have to come up with something that would be lightweight enough that would provide the degree of radiation protection that you wouldn't kill people to go to Mars.
Yes, or at least wouldn't cause you to get cancer several years later.
Yeah, yeah.
Can I throw something?
Yeah, absolutely.
And I agree with
John.
Everything Anita said, but I think the fundamental issue for putting people on Mars is power. We can't put people down for more than a day or two without providing the power to support them, to support the habitats, to support the fuel production, to provide the capability to live there and get off. That's where we need the breakthrough. All those other things that are required for robotic missions, they can be done. The big problem is if you want people to go to Mars and to stay there, well, they have to stay there at least 4 months. And there's dust storms and everything else. So solar panels are a problem.
Yeah, I was going to ask about solar, but that's not
solar is not solar is not going to work. Solar would work on the moon where you have 2 weeks of sunlight, and then you have to have 2 weeks of battery power. So that's a big problem. But the idea of going from moon to Mars is that you want to develop the technologies that you're going to need at Mars. You want to develop them and demonstrate them at the moon, where it's much safer. You're not putting the astronauts as much risk, if you were to try something out, at Mars for the first time. You'd rather do that and get that nailed down. So technologies that are going to be used for that purpose have to be extensible to Mars. There's no point in investing the money to make the possible on the moon.
What about nuclear? Is there a way to protect the astronauts and use nuclear power?
Well, nuclear power is the answer. There's no question about that. We're going to have space reactors. And we've made a lot of progress in that arena just in the last few years, actually. There's a program now at NASA and DOE called Kilopower, which refers to a small reactor that we've designed, built, and tested. Last year, we got through 6 months of a test program with it in February, March of last year. Very, very successful. And NASA, I think, I was going to say they're looking very seriously at it, but I think it's more than that. I don't think there is another alternative, and it's going to get developed, but it's going to take a while, too. But to go back to the moon just for 2 or 3 days, people are going to say that's Apollo on steroids. the idea of sustainability, to make living on the moon and ultimately on Mars permanent. You have to have a permanent source of power. The rest of the technology will come.
Do you support going to the moon as part of the research into going to Mars, or do you see no point in going back there?
Well, that was an argument that we had right after the Apollo program. People said, well, we go back to the moon. No, we've already been to the moon. Let's just go right to Mars. That's what Poppy was talking about, you know. And we tried that. That was the original Constellation program that started up around the turn of the century. And we got into it, and the schedule kept slipping because we were finding new things that we hadn't thought about that were going to need to be done. The cost was going up. Finally, NASA called in a big review program. It was headed by Norm Augustine, who had been a major player in the whole aerospace industry. And he put together this big review and came back to NASA and said, look, going to Mars is simply not affordable at today's state of technology, and with the budget outlook that's all reasonable, you got to pull back, develop the technology, and then set for Mars. So that's where now it's moon to Mars. Moon is a stepping stone, and moon is a place to develop the technology that you're going to need at Mars before putting the astronauts at risk by trying it out for the first time on Mars. Yes, I support that. I think that's exactly the right step.
We're talking with John Cassani, a veteran of Jet Propulsion Laboratory for decades, going back to 1955, all the way, got a front row seat for Apollo, all the other missions he worked on. We're coming your way from KPCC's Crawford Family Forum. It's one small step 50 years later as we look at the landing of Apollo 11 and the first spacewalk. Anita Sengupta, USC professor, what do you think about the moon as the step? Does that make sense?
So there is elements of the technology that can and should be demonstrated on the moon, but there's elements of the technology that can't because the moon doesn't have an atmosphere. My concern is that the challenge that we face with the space programs around the world and space exploration in general is insufficient amount of money, which is being invested by governments, and therefore we look to the private sector to have that happen. So if we can use a stepping stone to the moon to actually facilitate private sector investment, because you can have, space power, which is beamed from the moon, or mining operations on the moon. That's also a way to help on that front. But I think there is a financial limitation. And if I had to pick one versus the other, I definitely would pick going to Mars versus the moon. But ideally, being able to do both is the right way to do it.
Peter Westwick, as a historian, I wanted to ask you about the sorts of intangibles of all this, because I look back and I think of Southern California. Starts to be settled as the railroad comes to Los Angeles, brings people out, particularly from the Midwest. And so you see transportation having a huge role in the development of Los Angeles as a major city. And you mentioned aerospace earlier, coming out of this interest in aviation and exhibition and the like. And we see the Apollo and how inspirational it was for individuals. What's your sense of how all of this relates to sort of how we think of ourselves as Californians, risk-taking, entrepreneurship, the sort of notion of the California dream? Is this all entwined?
Yeah, that's a that gets to kind of the heart of a lot of this stuff. And we talk about, one of the things about the earlier aircraft industry and the interest in aircraft here was it was this very kind of, we talk about blue sky thinking. In this case, literally blue sky. They're going up there and exploring this new dimension for human activity. And that a lot of this kind of taps into this kind of, it's this intangible California factor, a characteristic that California has. So there's these concrete reasons why aerospace located here, research universities like Caltech, local boosters, believe it or not, cheap land and open space. But one of the factors was this kind of cultural factor of, this willingness to take risks, entrepreneurial, creative. Commentators from, Richard Neutra to all the way down have talked about, California is a very creative society. And a lot of this goes back to, think about the original people who came out here for the gold rush. They're willing to take, tremendous financial and physical risks to try to make their way here in California. And a lot of that spirit animates a lot of the early aircraft industry and then endeavors like Apollo. So there's this kind of like optimistic, future-oriented approach, but it's tempered by kind of the historical reality of these kind of booms and busts of, you come out here and you try to make your way, and sometimes you fail. And a lot of the aircraft builders, a lot of the early aircraft firms failed. Space projects failed and got canceled. And even the whole aerospace industry, I mean, one of the interesting things about Apollo, the moment of the moon landing in July 1969, there was this kind of almost ambiguous tone here in Southern California because NASA's budget had already started to contract hugely starting in 1966. And in 68, it really kind of started to drop really steeply. So by 69, people, the workers in the aerospace industry were really, you know, at this moment of celebration when look at the culmination of all our work over the past decade. But at the same time, they're looking over their shoulders for the pink slip. So this real, I mean, from 67 to 72, 50,000 aerospace jobs, about a third of the aerospace workforce in Southern California disappeared. So right at the moment of Apollo is when there's also this wave of layoffs going through the industry. And it's through this really kind of interesting time of celebration, but also tempered with hard realities.
And the cultural effect, I think, of is so significant because you mentioned just sort of the entrepreneurial risk-taking personality, but I also think of it as somewhat socially conservative at the same time. You know, this was not a union town, unlike other major American cities, which provided opportunities to for hiring without having to worry about union rules and the like. Your sense of, you know, how much that was a factor with this population of new employees.
Right, and there's this kind of interesting thing of you know, the defense component and the security regime, all this contributes, I think, to some of the it encourages conformity politically. I mean, if you think about another aspect of this moment here in L.A. in summer 1969, the mayoral election between Sam Yorty and Tom Bradley is underway, a very bitter campaign, and Yorty ends up winning. And there's this kind of – there's a moment of, you know, which way is L.A. going to tilt, and they tilt back with Yorty to this kind of conservative vision of the city. So it's this very interesting historical moment here in L.A. where all this stuff is kind of playing out, and Apollo is right at the heart of it.
For Los Angeles, this is a substantial African-American population. How heavily were they employed in these engineering facilities?
Not very. Not very much. I mean, same goes for, you know, women and other minority groups. They were underrepresented, you know, maybe a few percent, depending on the institution. But some of that is not so much the institutional racism of the companies, but more just the fact of the engineering workforce in the nation.
The education level.
You know, they just were not going, and some of that then traces back to university recruitment. And for women, example, you go to engineering schools. Well, first of all, schools like Caltech were not co-ed. You know, Caltech just in the early 70s goes co-ed. So, and other engineering schools were similar. So there were, I mean, the opportunities for women to enter the engineering workforce were very constrained. And then you talk to women who did go to the schools that were co-ed, and they go into the engineering building and, hey, I'm here for my first week of classes, and where's the women's restroom? That's across campus in the humanities building. So they're like, wait, what? So these are kind of obstacles, just, you know, seemingly mundane, but also reflecting kind of more powerful underlying obstacles.
Yeah. Briefly, Anita, I mean, what was your experience? Because you obviously come well after this, but were there vestiges at all of those cultural barriers and what were those?
So I'll give you my very first experience of visiting an engineering college as a 16-year-old for an engineering weekend at, I think it was RPI in New York. So we all had to stay overnight because it was two nights. And so I was sitting in the lounge inside of the whatever student room that I was staying in, like the lounge area. And I was just sitting on the couch watching TV, and a male jumped on top of me. Like, and I was 16, right? And so I was like, oh my God, right? Because in that school, they had like maybe 20% at most women, probably more like 15%. So that was my first experience with being in an environment which had very few women in it. So it was pretty bad.
Wow,
in that
welcome
sense.
To
and
college
so,
visit.
And
wow.
I decided not to go to that school for that particular reason. And then I went and visited another undergraduate school where they were giving me a pretty much a full scholarship, Boston University. It was a lot better in terms of women and having women's engineering programs. And so that was kind of key for me, having an environment that was healthy and safe, as opposed to my first experience.
Because there was a lot of recruitment of women going. I mean, you were quite wanted, I assume, by these, even if you didn't feel welcome when you got there.
Yes, apparently.
Not in that sense.
But I think the challenge is that, so one of the reasons why we did this book project was to get more exposure to young girls as to the fact that there are people who look like you who are on these fields. So I think the recruitment and the exposure has to happen really early on from when you're a little kid. And fortunately, my father was an engineer, so I was always exposed to what it means to be an engineer. And I never saw the gender gap because it was my dad, and you just don't think about that. But I think that's part of the challenge is not having enough people out there who they can relate to.
Anita Sengupta, John Cassani, Peter Westrick, thank you all very much for being with us, having this conversation on this very important 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 landing and the first walk on the moon. Let's go back to that culminating moment.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
History made, and of course, the influence of that continues 50 years later. And we thank you for joining us for this special edition of Air Talk, One Small Step, 50 Years Later. We appreciate it very much. We'll be back with you Monday morning at 10 for the next Air Talk here on 89.3 KPCC. Have a great weekend.